I thought what I would do today, just to have something nice and easier to discuss, was to continue the cationic reactions that we had started the other day. As we had done the formation of hemiketals, hemiacetals, ketals, and acetals. And it was another example of this protonate open attack deprotonate mechanism. Now, did we talk about the concept of a protecting group?
No.
Okay, so we only did that so far in the other section. So that's where I want to start, in fact. Because I also previewed the Grignard reaction with you the other day, did I not? Okay. So, let's just review a quick Grignard reaction, what one would look like synthetically. We'd still need to come back and talk more about mechanism, so that's partly why I want to avoid that topic too deeply today. But, start out with an alkyl halide. React it with magnesium, and then one of two solvents normally is used. Diethyl ether or THF, both of which I think we discussed the other day. And the reason you need this is because the compound, the product that's formed, only forms easily if the lone pairs from the oxygen from the ether or the THF coordinate with the magnesium. So if you don't have one of those solvents around, this formation just doesn't occur. You make an alkyl magnesium halide, which then you could react with an aldehyde or ketone, or next quarter you'll learn that other carbonyl compounds can do the same reaction, which our textbook lumps them all together, which I know makes it a little bit more complicated for you all to study. But let's take something easy like ethanol. The tack occurs, pushes open the carbonyl bond. We end up with a alkoxide plus, let me highlight the fact we have this new carbon-carbon bond. And then there's an acid workup step following it, which we can get to the alcohol. So, what if we wanted to do a Grignard reaction and we wanted to use this as our Grignard reagent, or to make a Grignard reagent from this? What's going to be the problem with it? Can you look at that and see why we might have an issue trying to make a Grignard reagent from that starting material? Well, what functional group does it have in it? A ketone. Doesn't that mean that the reagent would just turn around and react with itself? So as it's forming, in other words, before you have the chance to react it with some other molecule, it's going to react with its own self. So, yeah, you might get a reaction if you threw this in magnesium and bromine, but the reagent would react with itself. Maybe not within the same molecule. It's not that it can reach around and make a three-membered ring or something like that, but one molecule will react with another of its same kind. So you'd never have the chance to throw it at a different aldehyde or ketone. So what if we had some way, though, to mask the fact that we have a carbonyl bond there? What if we could do something to hide temporarily the carbonyl bond? Well, if we were going to do something like that, we would prefer it be something that's reversible, so that whatever we do to mask it, we could undo to get it back later. Well, didn't we learn on Monday a way to convert the carbonyl to a functional group that could then be converted back again? How about the acetals and ketals that we learned about? Because we could take this ketone and react it with this alcohol. I only keep using this particular diol because it makes this very convenient five-membered ring intermediate, this product. So it's a very common trick that's done. Another alcohol would work, though. We could use ethanol or something else. Usually you use some kind of inexpensive alcohol to do this reaction. Won't write the mechanism since we did that the other day, but a few rounds of protonate open attack, deprotonate later. And we have this. So what we just did is we protected the carbonyl. That group we know is susceptible to acid, because that's the way that we would go in the reverse direction. If we took acid and water, we would destroy that ketal that we just made. By the way, how do I know that that's a ketal versus an acetal? Right, came from a ketone, which means there's no hydrogen at the carbon where the two oxygens are connected. So it's acid sensitive, but it's not terribly base sensitive, because that's not really a leaving group, the oxygen minus. Kind of the same reason why hydroxide's not a good leaving group. And so what we could do is we could react this with magnesium in ether, and we could form the Grignard reagent. Now we could throw whatever ketone or aldehyde we did want it to react with. Let's say we also reacted it with ethanol. So reaction occurs. Oops, got ahead of myself here. Before the acid, we don't have an alcohol, we have an alkoxide. If we then used dilute H+, where we were just giving enough to cause a neutralization reaction, we could, in theory, end up with just the alcohol, while still retaining the protecting group. Later on, if we then use acid and water and purposely hydrated it, we get rid of the protecting group, get back the ketone. So that would be the deprotect step. So one of these kinds of synthesis usually happens by protecting it. You do whatever else you needed to do, and then at the end you deprotect. And there are several different functional groups that have these protecting groups available. I started with a ketone, because it's chemistry we just learned the other day. I want to show you one more example of a protecting group that's used for alcohols. So I know we were kind of passing out of the alcohol chapter, but now the exam's over, we got a chance to work some more on synthesis. Starting next week, we are going to be doing more and more synthesis problems in class, because aside from your general level of panic yesterday or Wednesday, I'm getting the impression that it was more the synthesis problems than anything else that were making you stressed. So we're going to do more practice of that. But let me show you this protecting group for an alcohol. Yes?
Can you reverse the reaction?
Can I reverse the reaction? Which part of it?
From the product, can we get the reactant?
No, because once you do the Grignard reaction, breaking a carbon-carbon bond is not very favorable. So protecting and deprotecting is reversible. A Grignard reaction is not. And this will be something that when we come back to Grignard, they'll say it right down. But think of it this way. If you had a Grignard reagent that effectively is acting like an alkane, that's got a conjugate acid, the alkane itself, that is got a pKa between 50 and 60. The alkoxide's got a pKa of about 16 to 18. So there's a huge difference in the base strengths of these two reagents. So what you can say is, how could the alkoxide, which is a weak base by comparison, be able to kick off a carbon-carbon bond to make something that's a super strong base? It wouldn't, and that's why the reaction's not reversible.
How about the previous reaction?
Which previous one?
It's the same thing.
Now, we learned vinic in lab the other day, but that's also irreversible.
Yeah. In
Right. And there is a way to break a carbon-carbon bond. One of the most direct reactions we could do is called ozonolysis, which we'll study later on in the quarter. But no, we don't know a way yet just to reverse this formation. Now, let's see that protecting group for alcohols. I'm going to show you one that's sometimes mentioned in OCHEM texts. It might not be in yours, but it's got a close cousin that's in there. It's a silicon-containing reagent. TBDM. Actually, no. Let's make it closer to the chemistry you're doing right now. We'll do DHP, which stands for dihydropyran. We learned about furan the other day in order to learn about the name THF, tetrahydrofuran. Pyran is very closely related chemical, but instead of a 5-membered ring, it's got a 6-membered ring. So this is pyran itself. Then dihydropyran means hydrogenate one of the 2 double bonds. And it is a protecting group for alcohols. And let's see, what do you think might would happen if we reacted it with an alcohol? Now, a very small trace amount of acid is sometimes added just to initiate this process, but the process happens almost by itself. But let's say there is an H plus around. Well, with an alkene like this, you'd expect the first step of the reaction would be for the alkene to react with hydrogen, which it does. Now notice I put the carbocation next to the oxygen. I'm going to explicitly show a resonance structure, which I know I often don't do. But I'm doing it in this case to emphasize that even if we had had some substituent at this other side of the double bond, which would make it the more substituted carbon, reaction's really not going to happen there because of this lone pair almost instantly being able to delocalize and stabilize, therefore, the positive charge. I'm also showing you this because next quarter we're going to learn a reaction with sugars in which much the same kind of mechanism occurs. It's thought to be directly because of the fact that the lone pair is involved that a particular reaction happens. So this really is like a carbocation, though. And let's now imagine that we had some kind of alcohol along. Well, that alcohol is going to attack the carbocation, or since I've made this resonance structure, it's going to attack the carbon, which will push this carbonyl back open. We temporarily have an oxonium ion. Which then gets deprotonated. Oops. Now, if I look at just this much of the molecule, what I've circled, what functional group would that be? It's an ether, that's right. And then this ring, it comes from pyran, but it's got 4 hydrogens on it now. So this is called a tetrahydropyranyl ether. That's the type of protecting group it is. The abbreviation is THP. And so standard type of disclaimer applies. Most likely on an exam, I would phrase it in such a way where I'd want you to write that full group out first, just the first time, and then every step afterwards, you can abbreviate it with THP. Why would I want to do this protection?
Well, what would happen if I tried to take that difunctional molecule that had both the ketone and the alcohol? What would happen with it if I reacted it with propyl magnesium bromide?
What would be the one and only product that would result?
Well, the answer is propane.
Because Grignard reagents are basic, and alcohol is acidic, at least compared to a Grignard reagent. And so before the Grignard has a chance to attack the carbonyl, the deprotonation is going to happen first, because acid-base reactions are generally the fastest reactions that happen in solution. So if we wanted to attack the carbonyl, we can't have the alcohol around. Well, that's the whole point of that THP group. You have an ether, which ethers aren't leaving groups, and so it lets you do the reaction.
That's the point. So a Grignard reagent Grignard reagents cannot react with ketones or aldehydes in the presence of protic molecules, since a rapid acid-base reaction would occur instead. And so, that's the whole point of using the protecting group. Now, I should let you know, I'm showing you protecting groups, we're going to use protecting groups, but it's not going to be the only synthesis we do the whole quarter. There's an entire course you could take on protecting group synthesis, so it's not that all of a sudden we're going to add this as a permanent complication of synthesis. You do need to know that it is a technique, though. So let's see that now. I had taken that difunctional molecule, reacted it with DHP, I made the THP ether. I could then react it with a Grignard reagent if I wanted to. The THP ether will remain intact. I'll add my new carbon group to it. I'll originally get an alkoxine. Again, if I use dilute H+, all I'm going to affect is making the alkoxide neutral. If I wanted to blast off the protecting group at the same time, I could. Just use strong acid and water. But maybe you want to do some follow-up reaction. You don't want the protecting group to be gone right away. So that's why I'm showing this with dilute H+, so we can see the step-by-step process. Yes? If you don't have what? The protecting group, then exactly what I showed you right up above here. The Grignard reactant is going to deprotonate that alcohol instead. Now, a real-life way around that, sometimes, instead of doing a protecting group, is if your Grignard reagent's cheap, just add a whole bunch. Because once you deprotonate the alcohol, well, then the carbonyl is still there to be attacked. So sometimes you'll waste some Grignard reagent, but then still be able to carry out your reaction. Of course, if your Grignard reagent's super-duper hard to make, well, then you wouldn't do something like that. Now, let me write out, instead of abbreviating the THP at this point, because if I am going to want to get rid of this protecting group, it'd be good to know how to do it. I'm going to ask you, before I circled a certain part of it, and you answered that that's an ether. But if I circle this part of it, what functional group is it? It is an ether, but what kind? A
a diether, what do we call that? I call it an acetal. Because look at it, it's two oxygens connected to one carbon, isn't it? Each oxygen has an R group on it. There is a hydrogen at this position where the two oxygen meets. Well, that's an acetal. It doesn't look like one. It didn't get created that way, but that's the sneaky thing about DHP. So all you have to do is react it with acid and water, and you'll make the alcohol. Now, you have to be careful doing this, because you can dehydrate tertiary alcohols, too. So if you did this and used a lot of heat and a lot of H+, you could cause dehydration potentially to occur. You will spit off a byproduct, which what will it look like? Well, it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbons in it. You'll have an OH group at one end because it made a circle with itself. The other end, since it's an acetal, it'll be in aldehyde. We don't care about that byproduct. That's just what you'll happen to get out. So that's another example of protecting, doing a reaction that would not be possible without the protection, and then getting rid of the protecting group. There'll be a couple other examples of protecting groups that we'll see throughout the quarter, but these two are good enough for now. So questions about protecting groups? All right, then let's move to cationic reactions. So we learned acetals, ketals, hemiacetals, hemiketals, because we had reagents that had oxygen in them. Now, let's see what happens with nitrogen. Before we do that, we need to review a little bit about amines. So I don't think we ever did nomenclature of amines, did we? Okay. And we're not going to do much right now, just enough to get us going. I'm only going to deal with what we call primary amines as far as nomenclature. And we'll talk about what the word primary means just momentarily. So, 3-carbon compound, that would normally be propane. But instead of propane, we're going to add the amine functional group ending. We don't put an E and an A right after each other in nomenclature, so it turns into propane amine. Very simple name. If we had a cyclic compound, same thing, cyclohexanamine. Now, what about these terms, primary, secondary, tertiary? Well, primary, which I'm in the habit of using 1 degree to represent primary, means 1 alkyl group on the nitrogen. See, when you're dealing with oxygen and we're dealing with alcohols, the focus is on the carbon, because what makes one alcohol behave differently from another has to do more with which carbon the alcohol is attached to. But the way that amines react is different. And so the way that amines react depends not on what carbon the nitrogen is on, but how many carbons are on the nitrogen instead. And so a secondary amine is one in which you have 2 alkyl groups. Tertiary is where you have 3. And then because nitrogen does have that lone pair, because it's a base, you can form what's called a quaternary ammonium salt. Because if you did put a 4th group on there, you would not have a neutral compound. But it is possible to make and isolate a salt that has four carbon bonds to nitrogen. Because it doesn't violate the octet rule, it just makes it positively charged. So, how do amines react then with aldehydes and ketones? Well, it's a little bit more complicated than just the plain protonate open attack deprotonate. In protonate open attack deprotonate, all we show happening is an H plus protonating the carbonyl, causing the rest of the reaction to occur. But it turns out that doing the same kind of reaction with an amine works best at pH 5. That if you get much more acidic than that, the reaction's not very favorable. You get much more basic than that, the reaction's not favorable. Now, why might you imagine that you can't have a very acidic environment if you wanted an amine to react the same way an alcohol would? What is the pKb of an average amine? Let me try that again. What is a pKb? A base dissociation constant, the equivalent type of thing of a pKa, an acid dissociation constant. All right? If you have NH3, ammonia, and you throw it into water, what kind of solution do you get? You get a basic solution, right? Ammonia has a pKb of 9.25, which means it's a weak base. Which means it's a base. Which means if you put it in an acidic solution, all that's going to happen is you'll get a neutralization reaction. The lone pair of nitrogen is nucleophilic. It actually has the potential to attack a carbonyl even without the carbonyl getting protonated first. It helps if it's protonated. Putting a positive charge in the carbonyl is what helps it open. But the amine can attack it directly. But if you were to put it in an acidic solution where you have a positive charge instead of a lone pair, is a positive charge nucleophilic? What does nucleophile mean? It wants positive charge. Does a positive charge want to be next to another positive charge? No. So if you put it in an acidic solution, it makes the amines unreactive, at least in that way. So, amines are nucleophilic. But they are also bases. If an amine is placed in an acidic solution, it will become protonated and therefore no longer nucleophilic. So in other words, put an amine in something like HCl, and you'll make a salt. Now look at the back of some of your over-the-counter medications this evening. If you see anything that's .HCl, this is exactly what it means. A lot of medications are nitrogenous bases. They have nitrogens in them. But those compounds aren't water-soluble. Well, if you're eating something, the inside of your stomach, at least, is water-soluble. And so what if you want to try to get a medication in you? Well, to make it water-soluble, sometimes you'll make the salt like this. So if you have one of these medications, I think Dramamine even comes in that form for motion sickness. Look at the back of it, blah, 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 .HCl. It means it's been reacted just like this in order to make an ionic salt. A little bit of a side story there. So coming back to this reaction I'm about to show you, the ideal pH of the following reaction
is pH equal to 5.
So let me show you the slightly modified reaction mechanism. And one could argue whether this is the correct one or not, because this is going to involve ammonia or an amine, which is a weak base, pushing open a carbonyl, which makes an alkoxide, which is a strong base. So you could argue, though, at the same time, how could you protonate a carbonyl first if an amine is basic?
So there's some argument you could make about the mechanism, but I'm going to follow the way that it's very normally presented. So if I start out with a ketone, for example, and I throw at it a primary amine, the first reaction step that we'll see is the attack first. And again, the rationalization for this is that an amine is basic. Notice I am showing it as a reversible mechanism, because the functional group I'm about to form can be decomposed reversibly.
Now, what's going to happen first? That ammonium salt that I just made,
if I remember to put the other hydrogen in,
that ammonium salt that I just made, would that get deprotonated first, or will the alkoxide get protonated first? Yes. Meaning one or the other is going to happen. It doesn't really matter which one is which. It is unlikely they would happen simultaneously, though. So I wouldn't show the alkoxide reaching out to grab the hydrogen from the nitrogen. But I'm just pointing out which one you show happening first is kind of unimportant.
So I'll go ahead and show that being protonated.
Now, because we are in pH 5 solution, it is acidic, so it is okay to have H+, even though I started out the reaction as if it was in basic conditions.
So I know this one's a little trickier conceptually. But once we get past this point, then the rest of the reaction is going to look just like what we've seen before. So we have a deprotonation. And we end up with an intermediate that's halfway between where we started and where we ended up with. And this intermediate has the name carbinolamine. Which means it's half alcohol, half amine. It's going to continue to react. Yes, the amine can get protonated. And in fact, the amine's more likely to get protonated first because it's more basic than the oxygen. But if the oxygen gets protonated, we can eventually end up with an intermediate that is isolated. So now it's a cycle of regular old POD. Protonate, open, attack, deprotonate. So protonate, open, now this is a different kind of attack than what we've seen before.
Because previously at this step, we'd have, if this was alcohol we were reacting with, we'd have a second molecule of that alcohol come in at this point. But intramolecular interactions or reactions are generally faster than intermolecular reactions. What I'm getting at is the fact we've got this lone pair here.
If you go back and look at the equivalent mechanism with alcohols, there is a lone pair on the oxygen in that reaction as well.
But if you close up an alcohol that's already got three bonds to it, well, actually, that's not even possible. You wouldn't be in this situation. In that, if you did that reaction, you'd end up with something that had no place to go. You'd have a double bond to oxygen and a single bond to oxygen. Neither of them would break easily, so oxygen would never close up in this way.
But nitrogen is trivalent. And so once it makes a double bond and it's still got a hydrogen on there, it just loses the hydrogen.
And so you end up with a carbon-nitrogen double bond.
This is a compound called an imine. So imine is when you have carbon-nitrogen double bond. No, that's my pen not doing a good job making a dot.
Now let's see a closely related reaction. What happens if we react a secondary amine and do this exact same process? Now what does secondary mean? You got two alkyl groups attached to that nitrogen instead of just one.
So, start with the same ketone. I'm going to react it now with a secondary amine.
This sequence of arrows means after a few steps.
Which, I guess to highlight the fact this is reversible, I better make them three reversible arrows.
In other words, I'm not going to write the first part of the mechanism over again because it works exactly the same waves we had before. So I'm going to jump to the carbonylamine.
What does that look like? Well, I would have pushed the carbonyl open, so we have the alcohol, and then it's part amine as well.
So we have the amine that's added in. During that addition process, it has to lose one hydrogen. Oh, you're kidding me. It's not an alarm, is it? I guess that was outside.
Okay. It's like, let me finish my lecture, please. All right, now the next round of what would happen. Protonation gets us water. Oops, only one lone pair there. That's going to come off as a leaving group. Now notice, I could write a resonance structure. And I said before that nitrogen can tolerate having a positive charge, and that is true.
But once we get there, there's nowhere for it to go. You've got a positive charge that can't be relieved somehow, and so it's not possible to isolate this compound. So this is what doesn't happen. What does happen?
Well, if we still have some more of that amine in solution, it's a base. A base could pull off this proton, causing elimination to occur. You therefore end up with a single bond to nitrogen, but a double bond from the carbon connected to that nitrogen and its neighbor.
Now, previously, when we'd made a molecule like this that had an alcohol and an alkene, what do we call that? An enol, right? So what are you going to guess that an alkene and an amine is called?
An enamine. And that's exactly right. Enamine.
Not adiamine, no. I'm sorry, not adiamine. Edamame. That's the word. So, why are we able to form this? Well, because it's the only thing that can form. And it is isolatable. Why didn't we make this the first reaction around when I used that primary amine? Why did I not make an imine? Or why did I make an imine and not an enamine? Which, if you're noticing, we have amine, imine, enamine, and later on we'll have amide and imide to throw in there as well. So you're going to have enough names that are confusing. You just got to get used to it.
So, if I had tried to take, let's say, an aldehyde and a primary amine and react them together, the enamine would look like this. But guess what? It will turn in to the imine.
Now what's happened here? It looks like a double bond and a single bond have traded places with each other. Is this a resonance structure? No. So what is this called? Last quarter, when we tried to make an alcohol out of an alkyne, we ended up making an enol. That enol reacted in such a way where a single and a double bond appeared to switch places. What was that process called?
Well, that's the exact same thing here. This is a tautomerization reaction, which now that I've identified it, let me write the mechanism for just tautomerization. Since this is normally going to be happening in acidic conditions if we're making these kinds of compounds, double bond gets protonated and opens up. It forms a carbocation right next to the nitrogen, which I've already identified has a lone pair that would easily delocalize. The double bond would now form to the nitrogen instead, making a positive charge, which can get relieved by deprotonation. And we end up in the imine.
Why would this happen? Because this overall process is exothermic.
Well, okay, that's not good enough.
I know it's exothermic. I'm pretty sure it's exergonic as well. Why am I guessing that? Because we got one molecule going to one molecule. So I'm guessing there's not that much change in entropy. Reason I would care if it's exergonic versus exothermic, exothermic means release of energy, but it doesn't mean the reaction's spontaneous. Because just because there's a difference in energy between reactants and products, we also got to include entropy as far as whether the reaction's favorable. But again, guessing that there's a minimal change in entropy, and I know that it's exothermic, I'm going to guess it's also exergonic. So the reaction happens, or this enamine won't form, because it's not the most thermodynamically stable product. Now we're out of time today, so are there any questions before we wrap up for the week?
So, lab report one is due Monday, right?
Lab report one is due on Monday, that's right.
What if you were unable to do the IOM?
Then you need to, when you come to lab on Monday, tell me that so you can take your take your IR, and then I'll let you turn your lab report in on Wednesday. But only if you don't have the IR completed. Now, the whole class shows up and says, I don't have my IR done. Then I'm going to think something a little suspicious about it.